excited to introduce you to Professor Danny Dorling. He doesn't really need any introduction, so I won't bother. I'll just allow Danny to speak for himself. So.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for the invite. It's great to come somewhere where it only takes me 12 minutes to get there. That's very good. I thought of talking to you about people going into schools and speaking, because you obviously know far more about schools and school children and most of the geography curriculum than I do. What I know about is what it feels like to be invited to come to a school to do a tour. And the kind of things that teachers get wrong. It's no fault of their own that they get it wrong. But given that you've got enough interaction with teachers, you could help a future generation of geography lecturers have a better time when they come into schools. And also, more controversially, I want to talk about the issue of discussing sensitive issues with school children in schools, because I invariably get asked to come in to talk about inequality, because somebody's gone and stuck it in the curriculum, haven't they? Has this happened, am I right? I assume this is partly why. Anyway, the first thing, the most important thing, school teachers need to know that geography lecturers and other invited speakers can't necessarily work out how to get to the school on their own. particularly if the school is based in London. This may sound trivial, and of course if you're a teacher you know how to get to the school because you go to the school every day. But in London it actually matters to know that there is a particular train station near it or some other way of getting there, so that you don't end up spending 2 hours getting to a school which should only take you half an hour to do. And geography teachers in particular seem to think that just because somebody's a geographer, they ought to know how to do this. So just remember, idiot-proof instructions on how to actually get to the place is the most important thing. And the least instructions you ever get are from school teachers. Other people, when they invite you to give you talks, will give you very detailed instructions of how to get to where they want you to be, maybe because they're more used to people coming. And there'll also be in institutions like universities which will have a campus map on their website. Schools don't have a kind of how to get to us map on their website. I won't go on about it anymore, but it's just, I begin to notice this kind of issue. The other thing that teachers need to know is that not everybody else is as busy as they are, because they're actually working quite hard. So when you come and do a talk in a school, essentially you turn up, and I must have done 30 or 40 in the last 3 years, you turn up and usually there isn't somebody there to meet you, or not the teacher, they've sent some kid or somebody else. And they have to rush out halfway through the talk because some emergencies happened. And then they've got to teach a class immediately when you've finished. But you might get lunch, but it's 40 minutes and so on. And this is completely normal for teachers. Like, this is completely normal for them. But they just need to realise that outside, in the University of the Third Age, in church groups, in protest groups, in other universities, people have so much time that they kind of swan around the speaker. Whereas teachers actually, this has made me realise how hard teachers work, is that it's like this when you turn up. The other thing is teachers don't realise how young they are. And this is partly me getting old. Maybe it's the schools that I've been invited to speak in, because it can't be that all the middle-aged teachers have gone. But very often when somebody comes to pick you up from reception, you're not quite sure if they're a sixth former or a teacher. A few of you must have had this problem, it can't just be me anymore. And then some teachers get really upset if you think that they're a pupil, because they're young and they don't realise how lucky they are that can still happen. In fact, I have slowly worked out it is always teachers picking me up because of child protection rules that you're not actually allowed on your own. But it's taken me some time to work out that that's the case. Inequality. Talking about inequality in schools. The first time I got involved with trying to do this was with primary schools. So we created, a group of six of us created a website called World Mapper, and a primary school in Sheffield said, can we come in and do a talk to eight-year-olds? And luckily I was quite nervous, and it was lucky I was nervous, because I got three primary school teachers involved in trying to create the presentation. And you can find it on the web. If you just type in World Mapper for Kids, you'll find a series of slides. And they're explicitly aimed at 7, 8 or 9, that kind of age group. And about trying to cover the issue of global inequality in a way that will result in not a single complaint from a parent. That's our kind of criteria. If you've seen World Mapper, you may not know the rationale behind World Mapper. The rationale behind it was not to get any complaints. And it's a fairly simple rationale. It's partly because you just can't deal with them. If you get... World Mapper ended up with 26 million hits on its most busy year. It's now going out of date. If you have 26 million hits, as soon as a tiny proportion of people start to complain, you've got a real problem with emails. And so what you have to do is make very careful decisions about what you present. So we have things like, we have no Tibetan border. We have Taiwan in a slightly different colour to China, but we never put the name Taiwan in. The Falkland Islands are coloured the same as Argentina, but labelled the same as Britain. There's all kinds of things we've managed to get away with. We have a map of voting, in which people actually vote in China, because the BBC says they do. I can go on and on and on. But we managed, with World Mapper, to not get people saying we had a particular political bias, which of course we had. I mean, everybody has a political bias over what they choose to show and not show and how they depict it. But our way of being unbiased was, can we minimise complaints? So then you have the problem of teachers want you to come and present things to children. And there's at least two issues. One is, my very lazy, can I get no parents to complain over whatever it is we do? And the second is, you really need to try and be as fair as you can to children, because they're children, and it isn't fair if you go in and kind of poison their minds in your particular way, maybe. Although my friend, if any of you know Carl Lee, who's the teacher I work with the most, he absolutely believes in the, I think he calls it the enlightening of minds, and calls his job propaganda. So, our job was to produce some slides and a talk that would work for 8-year-olds. So we took PowerPoint, we did some animated bits on PowerPoint so it looks a bit more exciting. We take a world map, we colour it in with kind of digital crayons. We put a few things like pyramids on it so that the kids can talk about where they know, which countries they know, and a kind of quiz about that. The immediate thing we find when we go and do this and present this is that the child who's the second best in any class at naming countries is normally the most able child of the middle class parent. But the child who is best in every class we've done this in at naming countries is the child of refugees. And I think it's a mixture of the child of refugees tends to have come from more countries, but also I just have suspicion that their parents have taught them more about places. Now, to show inequalities for 8-year-olds, what we decided to do was to look at the map of toys in the world. So we've got data about where all the toys are made, which essentially is China and Hong Kong, and a little bit of a craft industry in Italy, but to say that's what your map looks like, since it's largely China. And where all the toys are consumed, which is largely the USA and a bit of us, but the two maps are very, very different. So toys consumed by the children of the world. And then we have to do a little bit of an explanation of children have toys everywhere. It's just in many parts of the world you make your own toys. You don't actually buy bits of plastic that have been shipped around the world as your toy. To try to not make them think that most children in the world don't have toys just because they haven't had $400 worth spent on them at Christmas. And then you've got to be really careful. Now, I really wouldn't have worked this one out if it hadn't been for the teachers that we were working on. Because the key issue is Christmas. It's actually Christmas when a large number of these toys get made. And we're showing where all the toys are made, and we're showing where all the toys are collected. And these children are 7 or 8 years old, and you should get how we could have stuck our foot in it. So we don't show the large container ships, right? What we do instead is have something flying up to the North Pole and then down again. And this was actually incredibly... We don't say they're Santa. It's just for any child who happens to believe that that's how the toys arrive, they're not going to suddenly have their world shattered by a half an hour presentation by some strange person from a university wanting to talk about inequality. And it was those kind of things. Okay, religious issues, other things. But two fairies, Santa, that kind of business. And then you open it up. So I'm going to open this up in about 10 minutes for questions, so please think of them. Of course, with kids, you don't have to worry about that. They will ask questions. And the younger they are, the more questions they will ask. And when you're showing maps of the world, they only really have one question. It's normally from the boys. And the question is, what is the fastest way to get round it? I don't know why this is the case, but boys want to know, 8-year-old boys want to know how you can fly, speedboat, whatever, around the world and which way to do it. And I've just noticed this, doing this talk enough, that I'm hoping they're going to ask something a bit trickier. And it's travel around. Okay, I'm going to say something about older children and secondary schools. I did a little list, if anybody's interested, of 13 schools I've been to recently. The key point of doing the list is almost all the invites come from private independent schools. That's what happened. Almost all. I do slightly more than average, because Owen Jones won't do them. I get these lovely emails that go, Owen Jones won't come to our school because it's independent, will you? So I am the kind of fat old version of Owen Jones, so I'm clearly the second choice. But Owen Jones won't go to private schools. But also, it is largely private school teachers who do the asking. I mean, you're talking 90-95% of the requests. And if you get a request from a state school, it is almost always places like Camden School for Girls, which is very nice, but it's like 5 GCSEs, I don't know. To get into sixth form is quite tricky. It's beginning here with Charwell, by the way. Or Henrietta Barnett, which I just did in Hampstead recently, which is even trickier. So it tends to be the state schools which are nearest to the private school end, if you like. They don't think they are, just like Charwell here. Because these fairly posh state schools tend to be surrounded by very, very posh private schools, they think they're really, really state, even though they're essentially grammar schools. But those are the schools that I get invited to. Apart from the school I went to and the school my kids went to, the only comp which has invited me is one in South Oxfordshire, because the teacher went to school with me. I wish I had the time and energy, and I keep being turned down from an internal geography department bid for a grant to proactively say, can I go and speak here? But there's partly not a need to, because the few times I do speak in state schools, I'm often not telling the kids anything they didn't know anyway. In a sense. And we can raise it and sort of talk about why that might be the case afterwards. The other really interesting thing, the slightly disconcerting thing, is that if you do get asked to do quite a lot of talks, and you get asked a long time ahead, one thing I've tried to do is to suggest that pairs of schools might be willing to have me talk to all their kids at one go, so I only have to travel once. And of course the GA lectures are like this. So you do one GA lecture in Oxford and you've got kids from 7 schools in your lecture theatre. And you can tell because some of them got blazers, some of them haven't. Some of them look a bit worried, some of them look a bit too cocky, and so on. a few times now, enough to see a trend, I have suggested to the private schools, who were always happy to have the state schools come to them, that their kids could come to the nearest state school when I'm doing a talk. So I did it for Abingdon School, I've done it for... I didn't have the guts to do it to Eton, actually. They never take it up. They never take it up. The private school kids will never walk out of their school into the nearest state school for a talk. Because it isn't done. Okay, enough about that. It's just your kind of preoccupations if you're involved in this. I have a kind of set talk now, a sort of series of slides or pictures about the state of the country. Facts. Kids love facts. They're much happier, or appear much happier with facts and maps and graphs and things, and somebody waving their arms in the air like I'm doing to you. The thing I find most interesting is that I have one table which shows you how much you need to get into the top 10%. If you want to know, you're looking at about a household income of £60,000 a year before tax, you're in the top 10% of the country. To get into the top 1%, if you're a couple and you've got kids, you're looking at about £200,000 a year. Household income puts you in the top 1% by income. We can then go up to the 0.1% and what you need a million for, and you can go even higher. And I've gone up to what the richest three families in Britain have. So I have a kind of a table showing you where you are. Now, in some of the schools I've spoken to, I know that there are pupils sitting in front of me who are near the very top of that table. I don't say it, of course. I also know, but don't say it, that the posher the school, and almost the more expensive the entry for the school, the wider the inequality within the classroom will be. Now that means, and this is, say, schools not even letting in. There are some schools that let in 10% of pupils to nothing. But even the ones who aren't, you've got some people struggling at that 10% level or £60,000, and they're essentially not eating so they can pay the fees. You've got other people on £200,000 who feel poor because the chief exec's kids who are going to this particular school in London, they get 10 times more than them. And the sixth formers tell you about where their holiday was in China this year, one of their five holidays that they've had in the school. And there's this incredible social difference within the most expensive schools. And you're showing these kind of figures that slots them in. I often get some resistance to some of this in the more expensive schools when I kind of, because the implicit message is this is very, very unfair. And there are sort of ways of dealing with this, but you don't know how cocky to be. One lad last week said to me, "You just want to take our wealth away from us." And I kind of said, no, I'm very happy for you to still have your house. It's fine. I just would like it to be worth half as much as it's currently worth. But that's just money. You know, it's still a house. But then all other kind of things would work their way out. Let me say one last thing about 16-year-olds. As you know, they're very, very different from 18 and 19-year-olds. Well, that's what I've learned doing this. 18 and 19-year-olds have learned to modulate their views a bit. They might have them, but they've learned to hide them, particularly if they think you're going to be marking their work. But also because the 18 or 19-year-olds that I get to meet in four or five universities I've worked in have just gone through the most incredible process of social mixing in their lives. They've suddenly been put into a university, and universities for almost all children, even the two here, I mean, if I have a fun thing about the poshness of the two here, I think the Bull and the Club's moving up the hill. But even here, for any child coming in, you're going to meet people richer than you and people poorer than you and far different than your school. And that tends to mean that people hold back their views a bit. They're also getting subtle over they want to impress other 18 and 19-year-olds in the room, which tends not to work well if you shout your mouth off too much. So you get a very different story. 16-year-olds just give it you straight. They're unmodulated belief. And the most dog-eat-dog 16-year-olds you get in the country aren't the most expensive schools or the poorest schools. They're the ones who've passed the 11-plus in the grammar schools. And it makes sense, because these are kids who've passed this exam in those counties which have grammar schools, been told that they've done very well, and now they're in a school with everybody else who's passed the exam, and they're heading for a future where they're going to be better off than the people who didn't pass the exam, and that's entirely because they're cleverer, so they should get more. It's not because their parents have got more money. It isn't because they live in the right area or catchment area for another school. They've been chosen. They were chosen at 11 or 12. They're coming up to more and more exams, and of course, these are the human beings that we examine more than anybody else. We've never examined kids as much as we examine them now. They're given the implicit message that there are different values. Some people are very valuable, some aren't, and we've got to spend all this time examining you all the time to sort you out, move you up some sets, down some sets, and so on. And so it's that group, the state grammar school kids at 16, who are most Darwinian about what life should be like. The other very important thing about 16-year-olds and kids is, hopefully, for the vast majority, not the vast majority, because parents put up much more now, but for large numbers of them, nothing bad's happened to them. What takes away people's views that it should be survival of the fittest tends to be life experience. And of course, you can't have very much of that at 16. Often because their parents haven't got into the same school, they don't have anything transmitted from their parents about behaviour, so they're like that. Which contrasts, say, with the most expensive schools, the Cheltenham Ladies and the St Paul's and the Eton's and the Winchester's, where you've got old money telling you to behave in a certain way. So people are incredibly courteous at a very young age. Or the poorest schools, the poorest areas, where people know their area's poor. They tend to be incredibly proud of their schools. In poor areas, the best thing going is the school. In London boroughs, the schools have these incredible fences around them. And then these amazing GCSE results inside them. And shockingly, children not learning or swearing that much inside the school. But the minute you're outside of the security fence, it's a different world. So our children are in all these very, very different situations at these ages, and have a very different view of their world and where they're heading. So I'm, in a way, probably learning more from them than they're learning from me. And the last thing I'll leave you with, because you've had a long day, hopefully you've got some questions, is the main reason the teachers are inviting me to speak is that some of the pupils have annoyed them a bit, and they want me to sort of take them on. I get the impression that that's the main reason. A slight subsidiary reason is that some teachers seem to think I have some control over access to university places in Oxford, which I don't. But a number of times in the last year I've been presented with, come to dinner with these candidates. It's not going to help. I don't interview anybody here, but I have a free dinner. So thank you very much for listening, and please ask away, criticise, tell me how to do it better. Thank you.
By your comment about public schools not going into state schools. The GA grants that I've run, I have one public school, admittedly it's a public school in Blackburn, so it's kind of down the league table in terms of wealth. But they're quite happy to come to sessions that are in other schools. But I think it's probably down to their geography use.
For the GA they will. The GA is a mix, and the sport is as well. And so it was when I was doing a GA talk in Cheyney, I suddenly realised I was talking for the only time to a cross-section of Oxford. The only way you could get a cross-section Oxford audience of any age was actually the GA, where we had the full income distribution in front of us, because kids from peers had come as well. So I come to GA because it's kind of comfortable and arranged. It's the nearest secondary. that the nearest secondary is seen as those are the ones who will beat you up on the way to school and tease you because you've got to wear that.
Yeah.
And that's, so if you know these schools, I recently did a talk in Henton, what's it called? Henton Girls School, which is a school 75 metres away from my school, which we never went into. I mean, it's almost, it's not South African style segregation, but you know, these children never go into each other's premises in the whole 5 years of school experiences, either direction, between these schools that are near. It is quite stunning, really.
Could I just make a comment on how you could do it better?
Go
on. You're quite a high-profile geographer. You're often on Radio 4, you're often in the press. And one of my students, not a geographer, I have to say, one of my education study students, told me you were a journalist. Yeah. Could you make more of being a geographer?
Of being a geographer than a journalist? Of saying?
Saying who you are when you're writing these articles.
Oh, I could. They change it.
Do they?
If they agree with you, they call me an economist, which is an insult. that's the top place. Is they actually changed the title to economist. The next one down is demographer. And then, they don't like, they say sociology. Hardly any geographer. So I do put geography, but I could try harder. And I put cartographer as well, because I kind of quite like that, because I used to draw maps. But yeah, and I'll try and be more insistent.
What's your motivation to do these talks in schools?
Oh, okay. I get bored doing undergraduate lectures. and because there are loads of constraints on you doing an undergraduate lecture. Shown most recently, nicely, by Oxford University Geography Society, have actually asked me to do a talk for the Geography Society so I can say what I actually think. Because when you're lecturing, there's going to be an exam, you can't. That's part of the motivation. I do like doing this, but I hate talking to an audience who are forced to have you. So some of you are probably feeling you're forced, but students really are forced. University students are forced. I'm also interested in what people's starting opinions are. You know, if you're interested in writing things or producing radio shows for general public, you need to know what a general public believes, and the only way to do that is to get out there and you know, present something and see what you get back from people. So I wouldn't have realised how raw kids are at these particular ages. I wouldn't have realised how inquisitive. I mean, it's obvious if you've been involved in this, but you know, my experience starts at 18. You know, for years and years and years, the youngest I ever saw was an 18-year-old, and we thought they were very, very young. So learning that the primary school ones really are dead excited about everything. And if you could get Usborne, is it Usborne the publisher that's got school? Yeah, and kids, you know, there's huge interest there. Learning how different the views of children going through puberty are, essentially, and how strongly held they are. Is useful. And also, I suppose the other motivation is, it is the Carl Lee propaganda one. By 18 is almost too late. By 18 people have decided quite a lot of their views. They might change, but they come to university and actually have got fairly formed views. You form those views at younger ages. So if I'm interested in saying we should worry about the state of the planet, you really do need to reduce the amount of pollution your parents are doing because of what's likely to happen. Your key audience is younger than 18. And they can influence the parents. So my favourite example of that is being invited to talk to board level members of the banks. This is Barclays, HSBC and so on. It was the chief procurement officer of each bank, which is actually the lowest you can be on the board. CEO is the highest, finance officer is the next, chief procurement officer is low. But I was in the gherkin shape thing at the very top of this kind of board table, and I have to do a talk like this, but over lunch, which is really hard because you're trying to eat. And at one point, I was doing quite well, and then I completely lost them when I told them what my parents' pensions were. Now, my dad was a GP. Their pensions are not bad. He was a fairly frugal GP and not very greedy. And my mum and dad are absolutely happy. But at the time, they were on 14 grand a year pension. And I suddenly watched these board members just look at me with pity. Because they were so rich. And I managed to bring them back again by asking why they'd invited me. And the head one said he'd invited me because his son had stopped speaking to him. Particularly at Christmas, because his son had joined Third World First, whatever that organisation is, and had decided that his father was the problem. And stopped speaking to him at Christmas. And it's really, obviously, it would get to anybody. You know, if your kid stops speaking to you and sees you as part of the problem. And that's part of my little propagandary plan and the idea of showing Walt Bapper and making people think of the whole planet as this is your neighbourhood, is a kind of accelerated way through of learning for older generations is if your kids are telling you on Christmas Day this is how the world works, the one day, of course, of the year that you actually spend with your children if you are a board-level member of a bank, that may alter what banks believe faster than trying to go through them another way. But, you know, I'm not completely Maoist over what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. I was wondering if there's anything that you wouldn't do. I was just thinking, when I was a PGC tutor at Sheffield, we used to do the first lessons the students taught were in King Edward's, where they teach groups of six children, and they decide the theme, and one year they chose inequalities in Sheffield. And as you know, King Edward's School draws from most of the areas of Sheffield where there's huge inequalities and differences in health, life expectancy, everything. And it turned out to be a very sensitive thing to think about how to prepare, where some of the children might feel very bad about themselves or and have their inequalities exposed. Would you take on something like that? Would you talk about inequality in Sheffield in a school like King Ted's where there's such inequality?
I wouldn't have done King Ted's because King Ted's is where my 13-year-old chose to go. Okay, and it was just embarrassing too much. But it shows the effect. We let him choose. All but one other child, you don't know these schools, but at Lidgett, everybody else chose Tapton. Tapton is the top-ranked comp in the country. And he chose King Ed's.
Do you think it's a set? I thought it was a really difficult thing to prepare the students to do.
There are harder ones. I mean, I don't do racism. Partly I just find it very difficult. So I will never go on a platform with BNP or EDL people, debate with them, and I'm just no good at. There's some things I find too hard just emotionally to do. So that's kind of one way I draw the line is those kind of things. I've seen it in summer schools. I did a summer school in Cambridge for 17-year-olds where they mix pretty affluent kids with pretty poor kids. And the interesting thing there is that what matters at 17 is, are you good looking? It's actually, have you got spots? And the affluent kids are trying to pretend not to look affluent, so they're dressing down. The poor kids, of course, don't want to look poor. But there's a lot of sensitivity. I think carefully, and the older I get, the more, probably more carefully than I used to. And I ask the teachers. You know, what are they happy with me talking about? The easiest thing is when somebody asks you a question. And one thing to be very aware of is when you begin to notice children getting emotional because they haven't thought about some of these things before, and then you kind of stay off. So I've had one 16-year-old boy start crying on me. And I felt bad about it. But you never know. You don't know whether that might have been helpful later, or it was just, that was a really crap day.
Sorry.
so did you see a difference between...
Huge difference. Yeah, I went into a few in Sheffield. I did more going around the country, so I did 6 in 1 week once. Sheffield's the huge difference. There are the 6 kind of comprehensives on the hill that Baker let them keep their 6 forms, which are the very posh ones. The remarkable thing about Sheffield is it has hardly any private schools. It's about 2% of the kids go private. So you've got state schools which in a way are like private schools. And then I went out to the east to, I've forgotten the name of the school, but what I remember is it had that same kind of boundary fence where they have this cylindrical piece of concrete on top that they put around prisons, and they use the same company so that you can't climb over the fence. And of course you notice this when you go to schools, you notice the architecture. And I'm amazed that more isn't said or done about just how uninviting some schools are because of the security that's put up. The other thing I've noticed in London, which I'm sure you know, but it's shocking and it's been heightened last week, is the security around schools, very rich schools, because they're afraid of kidnap and terrorism. And that since the Charlie Hebdo thing, there has been an absolute warning saying something is going to happen in one school, but because of the, and you can see it when you're actually going in, you're just not allowed in unless they've got your name, and so on. And also, I get Queen Mary University; they have to check you out to make sure you're not a radical preacher, and I can come close to being a radical preacher. But that's a very much a London thing. And I suppose, and that's a shock. I won't go to St Albans. If I can't get there easily, I won't do it. I always say, get somebody else. So I'm doing a lot of London ones at the moment.
I came to a talk that you gave in Bristol about 2 years ago, and it was about car use and ownership. And I was really struck by how you described the difference between being a pedestrian in Sheffield and being a pedestrian in Bristol, where you risk getting completely mowed down and not even noticed because car ownership is so high. So I was kind of intrigued as to whether, you notice sort of
differences of niceness and politeness and, that still exists. I mean, you kind of look, I must have told I once watched one old man fall down in Bradford on the pavement and 3 cars pull in. Because that's what you do in Bradford. There is kind of, it's more heated down here. Bristol's more. I mean, there's a big difference in Oxford and London. In Oxford, people cycle at 12 miles an hour. In London, they're cycling at 20, 22. That's why people hate cyclists in London. Cycle at 12 here, because nowhere is any great distance. And also, somebody's going to tell me, the town's absolutely full of completely naive cyclists, because kids aren't allowed by their parents to cycle when they're kids. For the first time, they cycle is when they go to university. So they really are pretty dangerous, but that slows the whole lot down. There's a huge number of overseas students, which means an enormous number of people cycling on the right in the first week of term. it takes some time. So you begin to notice these differences. And I don't know who's from London now at rush hour, the pavements are not big enough. Mm-hmm. You can walk through London on a Thursday or Friday night. People are partying for miles as well. And of course, the average age of London is now heading below 30. And the nice thing about talking in schools is it gets you out of where you normally go. Because there are schools everywhere, so I get to see Barnet. I get to see, out of London boroughs that I would never have a reason to go to. And actually get to walk past streets of houses and, get an idea about, what a lot of money really means in terms of just the physical housing that you see. Got another question or two and then let you get to the bar?
So you talked about the word cartographer and how you quite third that. If you go back to geography as a child, So were you all always interested in maps, or what part of geography played in terms of school to where you are now?
I had a granddad who was a geography teacher, which was probably key. He was fairly determined I was going to do geography. So when I was six, he taught me about how to draw maps and how to make a 3D model of Shotover. That is where it comes from. And then growing up in Oxford, it's just really clearly a divided city, and you are your geography in this city. It was particularly divided. You've got very posh areas, you've got the car working estates. It's all mixed up now. So university lecturers are buying ex-council houses almost everywhere. Here's a brilliant example. Here, you're in Iffley Village, okay, very twee, looks very nice. Only one problem, the school catchment areas, which is why you won't see any children over the age of 11 here, and why the parents complain they can't find any babysitters, because they all leave. But this is Iffley Village. You can just go very near to Rose Hill. Rose Hill's now only got about three or four streets of the poor anymore, and they're about to go any minute. They will gentrify any minute. So it's exciting. It's interesting, the word geography, and we do need to make geography more exciting. I'm doing this little book with Carl Lee, which is aimed at A-level students and members of the public about geography, just called On Geography. And our big claim in this book, which is only 30,000 words, is that geography has become, for the moment, it always changes what it is, but geography is currently becoming the subject of the future, because it is the subject about climate change and about global inequality, and these are the two major issues about the future. And it really is about sustainability and how we're going to live across physical and human, and it's exciting. And you could make an argument that geography might have been a bit boring 30 or 40 years ago. I was taught the geography of how to run Nigeria, that was my A-level. And geography might become boring again in the future. It could even go the way of anthropology, which has almost died, isn't that? I mean, apart from a couple of departments, you haven't heard of anthropology. And it used to be the sister subject to geography. So disciplines can die entirely. But I honestly think you can make it a case to say this is potentially the most exciting subject for young people right now in the world that there is. Not because we've engineered that, it just happens to have fallen in our lap. But the case needs to be made, because geography has a really bad reputation in schools. I'm not quite sure why. I know why it has a bad reputation in universities, partly. Because it is a safe subject to do if you have to go to university and you didn't necessarily want to go, but you're expected for the background you are. So it's a subject that the future king had to do when he wasn't quite good enough to carry on doing art history. And I'll say it quietly between us, but we have this problem. For four universities, I've looked at the home postcodes of the entire undergraduate body, and in all four universities, the geographers have the poshest postcodes. So we are the safe haven subject for children who absolutely have to go to university, but can't do maths, can't necessarily read. I'm biting a bit. But this is a problem for the subject, which is why you want to become a bit like environmental science. If you remember, if you're my age, it was really easy to get into environmental science. You just had to wear some wellies and people didn't want to do it. And then it suddenly switched to being the hardest thing to do ever, because people started becoming green. And you want geography to become that subject that's a bit tricky to get into with a slight bit more ambition. And we need to push it up to that, rather than this is your easy GCSE. This is your kind of safe AS. And the other worry, I think it's happening in geography, is the one you pick the AS for that you're not going to carry on all the way through, because that's coming in, isn't it? Whereas the nice thing at the moment is you do four ASs and you discover geography is interesting and you drop one of the other ones, or one of the ones that you're not going to get the B in. The other thing worth saying before I take your question is, you know, the free falls happening this year. Any university can take any number of students of any grade this October, which means that We're getting a huge rise in unconditional offers because you're going to get paid 9,000 for them regardless of what they've got. So this is going to be chaos. Probably. I mean, it might not be. It's likely to be chaos in the coming months. And you're beginning to get some idea on the ground because teachers are saying, how come three of my kids have been given unconditional offers? What's Birmingham doing offering, you know, EE? And the higher the predicted grades for their students, the more likely they're going to get an unconditional offer because they really want the ones who are going to do well, because that brings your overall average up to make it look as if you weren't playing this game. And that's all new this year. Yeah. Is there one at the back?
Yeah, we've got some free time tomorrow, so as a geographer visiting Oxford perhaps for the first time, where would you recommend that we go?
If it was the summer, I would make you go on the river. It'll just be, but it isn't the summer, so you've got to come back in the summer. We ran for the first time this year a first year field class for our undergraduate geographers, taking them over the Charwell River towards this part of town, because it's not just the geographers, all the undergraduates in Oxford just stay in the middle if they don't come to see Oxford. It's a Saturday, so it's going to be quite busy in the middle. Have you got cars? I would be tempted to go over to Hinksey, to the golf club in Hinksey, which is about 2 miles away from the centre of Oxford, where it's about the only place you can actually get a view of the Dreaming Spires. You can't actually see Oxford from hardly anywhere. But Hinksey Golf Club, the near Balls Hill, you get the view of Oxford. And then think, when you're on the golf club, this is just 2 miles from the centre of the city. You can walk and cycle to the centre of the city. 40,000 people are driving to the edge of the city every day. Why have we got a golf club here? And it's off the floodplain. And if you go over to Hinksey as well and look down, you'll see why there's such a flooding problem. The really exciting thing about Oxford is to look at the flood map. It's the most dramatic flood map ever. There's some lovely pictures of the floods. The floods are getting worse. They're getting bigger, deeper, more prolonged. We're getting standing rains. You're seeing real climate change kind of going on. There's talk about building a relief river so that we can flood West London. I mean, that's if you can just get an aerial view. I mean, the nice thing about the flooding is that Oxford has a really well protected green, natural green belt that, it, apart from homes on stilts and boats, it doesn't make sense to build on. And if you get up there to the edge, you can look at the constrained green belt and ask, you know, what future should this town have? That's what I would do. Because I think the town's got two choices. One is to become like Windsor, you know, which has got Eton, kids wearing funny clothes. We've got kids wearing funny clothes. You know, nice castle, good place for tourists. And Oxford's going to get lots more tourists in the future. Because tourism's increasing dramatically because the middle class people in the world, after they've done London and Paris, where do you go next? Oxford could go like Windsor and be kept petrified. Or it could go like Freiburg, whatever. You know, kind of green, cycling, expanded city. It's the economically most successful city in the country and the most constrained. And the other one, if you want to laugh, go into town and go to an estate agent and feel good about yourselves. So when I arrived in this town, house prices were 9 times average incomes. This is a year and a half ago. After 6 months of looking for a house, they've risen to 12 times average income. By the time I managed to buy a house, they were 15 times average income, and we'd beaten London. I think that was me. So Oxford's currently going through its biggest ever housing inflation the city's ever had for an expensive city. We've beaten London because London has London wages. We don't have London waiting. So what on earth is going to happen to this city? And a quarter of people in the city are overseas born. That's the other, it's about one of the most cosmopolitan places in the country. It's not a single complaint from UKIP about Oxford. UKIP never say, look at this terrible mistake of Oxford. If we leave Europe in 2 years' time, this town's got lots of problems. The old university is the biggest receiver of European funds in the whole of Europe. It's the most successful in the whole of Europe. They all go. A large part of the workforce, particularly the cheaper workforce, are European migrants. This depends on Europe. It wouldn't disappear. There's so many things. It would be lovely if somebody were doing Oxford Field. You know, there's that field trip that you always do when you go to the Olympic site, which must have got a bit boring by now. I'm sure it was great. Sorry, the person who probably did it might be in the room. And it's going to skip another book. You know, you could do a great one about the future of Oxford, mixing, flooding and people, and so on. Is that enough? Is there any burning one, or can I let you get to the bar?
Danny, thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.